Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Wednesday, February 17th. We have a couple of things on our agenda today. First of all, I would like to make sure that the people who are members of the committee have their video on, if they have video today, and microphones on. However, anyone who's not on the committee should have camera off and audio off. Thank you. Let's start with roll. Call the roll, please.
Representative Hernandez? Absent.
Absent.
Representative Levy?
Here by audio only.
Representative Marsh?
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith?
Representative Smith is here by video.
Vice Chair Pham?
Present by phone.
Vice Chair Reschke?
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson?
Present by video. Thank you. Two items on the agenda. We'll take them in the order that they are printed on the agenda. I'm opening an informational meeting on county property assessment function. Mr. Alanak, will you present this topic for us?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So you have some representatives from OSACA, the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, who are going to present some information to you on the various aspects of the county assessment function. And I believe the panel is Eric Kanzler, Jim Colin, and Scott Langton, if I pronounced those names correctly.
Thank you. Will those three people on the panel please step forward to the virtual table. Turn your cameras on if you have cameras. Turn on the microphone, and you can proceed in whichever order you have already determined.
All right. Thank you, Chair Nathanson and Vice Chairs Pham and Reschke. For the record, my name is Eric Kanzler, and I am here on behalf of not only the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, but also the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors. As you'll hear throughout this presentation, they do share responsibilities, flip sides of the coin, if you will, and fall together under what we consider as local assessment and taxation functions, and or A&T for short. So for the purposes of the informational, I'm here really, quite honestly, just to introduce the two assessors that are going to walk you through things in detail today. And that is Jim Colin, assessor from Curry County, and Scott Langton, the assessor from Deschutes County, and also one of our two legislative co-chairs for the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. Jim is going to begin talking about A&T functions and what it is that assessors and tax collectors collectively do and why that matters. Scott is going to follow him up by talking about A&T funding, how it is that we're funded in a very, very rough sense, and why it is that we're facing funding declines year after year. So I am simply at this point going to stand by for questions of a non-technical nature, and I'll let Jim and then Scott take it away.
Thank you. Yeah. And could you give me an idea of about how long your presentations are, so that we can be thinking ahead about the public hearing on the bill that follows?
Well, we'll see how well coached Jim and Scott are in this regard, but I would sort of expect each of them is coming in between 5-7, maybe 8 minutes tops.
That's great.
Thank you.
Plenty of time for the public hearing too. Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Reschke and Pham, and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to present today. I'm Jim Colin and have served as Curry County Assessor since 1989. I'm the longest serving assessor in the state of Oregon. Curry County is the southwesternmost county in the state of Oregon and we have a population of approximately 23,000 people. Coincidentally, we also have approximately 23,000 taxable accounts in Curry County. This makes Curry County, by population and number of accounts, the 26th largest county in the state of Oregon. As perspective, in Curry County, we assess and collect approximately $29 million in property taxes for the property tax districts in Curry County. As compared to Oregon's largest county, Multnomah, which collects approximately $1.7 billion in property tax, or Oregon's smallest county, Wheeler, which collects approximately $2.5 million in property tax for their districts. In A&T, our primary goal is to assess and collect the property tax levied by all the school, city, county, and other special taxing districts in the state. The work we do provides primary funding source for those districts and other districts such as rural fire protection districts, ports, cemetery, and library districts. We also collect fees to support the Oregon Wildland Fire Protection Fund. A byproduct of administering the property tax system is that we have created a huge database of assessors' maps and parcel shape files, as well as ownerships, sales data, values, and property improvement inventories. This ownership map and additional data has become the base layer for the GIS system in Oregon. GIS has become a vital source of information for emergency responders, such as state and local firefighters, police, and ambulance. And it also the base for the statewide land use planning and highway departments. As you know, GIS is widely used by the public and other small businesses, such as realtors, mortgage companies, surveyors, and utilities. Assessors also work with enterprise zones and other exemptions of charitable institutions, as well as partial exemptions such as farm and forest land special assessments. Some of these exemptions are very complex and difficult to administer, but assessors administer these special tax programs to ensure that the benefits sought by the state and local governments are realized by its intended recipients.
Mr. Cullen, pardon me, I'm going to interrupt for just a moment. There's someone who's not speaking right now, but whose microphone is on, and it's causing just a little tiny bit of disturbance in the quality of the audio. Not sure who it might have been, but thank you. Go ahead. I hope to provide a clearer audio for those people listening.
Thank you very much. For A&T, our mission is unity in purpose, equity in assessment. This mission is a code of honor for assessors. We look to provide fair and equitable assessments. In A&T, our customers are not only the special districts who provide vital services to our citizens, but our customers are also the property owners and citizens of the state of Oregon. We strive to ensure that property owners pay only their fair share of the property tax burden. To do this, assessors' offices are continuously training and working to provide accurate and up-to-date market and assessed values. Assessors are exchanging ideas on best practices, collaborating on projects, and scraping all available resources together to get this work done. Even so, as you're aware, assessors are frequently called upon to defend our values in the tax court. As assessors, we know that the more efficiently we can accomplish this work for our customers, the greater benefit our districts can provide to the citizens of this state. As recently as the year 2006, Curry had 13.4 full-time equivalents in the A&T program. Then the Great Recession and virtual curtailment of O&C receipts dropped our resources down to 7.5 full-time equivalents. We dropped from a six-year reappraisal cycle to a pace of 18 years to completely reappraise all of the properties in the county. 2 years ago, I came to this committee to testify on behalf of funding a pilot project for Curry County to assist in our reappraisal efforts. That was not approved. I was, however, able to convince the Curry County Budget Committee to grant us one additional full-time equivalent in appraisal resource. We hired someone new to appraisal and are still training them, but we've had them with us for a little over a year and production is up. The last 12 months with the additional appraiser in our office has increased our production and dropped us from an 18-year reappraisal cycle pace to a pace of a little less than 11 and a half years. As people get trained up, we believe that by this time next year, we'll be on a production pace for a little less than a 10-year cycle on maintenance reappraisal, if we can maintain that level of funding. Ideally, we want to get back to a 6-year reappraisal cycle because if we find omitted properties, we can only go back 5 years to collect the taxes that districts otherwise would miss. A big part of our justification for additional reappraisal resource was the unpermitted or omitted property new construction value that we were finding. Our two main tools for discovering new construction are building permits and maintenance reappraisal. We found that not everyone gets building permits. Some things like paving or small decks don't require building permits. However, we are seeing garages, shops, complete remodels, or even new houses being built without permits. I don't know if you have the PowerPoint that I provided, but if you do, it shows a structure on the left, which is a structure that we did pick up. The people did take out a permit on that structure, but then several years later, we went back and discovered the structure on the right, which was a complete remodel in addition to that property where no permits were taken. From 2012 through 2019, we picked up a total of $30.2 million in unpermitted new construction values. This is construction for which building permits were not taken. That averaged to $3.8 million per year. In 2020, with the additional reappraisal resource, we found and put on over $6 million in unpermitted new construction values. So far this year, between November 1st and today, we've already picked up $4.7 million in unpermitted new construction values. Since 2012, that amounts to a value generating approximately another $300,000 per year in property taxes for county taxing districts, over half of which goes to schools. Under our current property tax system, Measure 50, the taxable values on these properties continue to grow by 3% every year. Overall, the extra appraisal resource is working out very well for us, and we are grateful for the resource as we are able to do a better job ensuring equity and property owners paying only their fair share. Thank you for allowing me some of your time today. I know you have many concerns to consider for the state of Oregon.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Can you stay with us for additional questions and conversation?
Yes, I am happy to. Thank you.
Sure. Great. Let's hear from the next speaker.
And Scott, before you start, I want to make sure that you guys have the chart that was sent, Scott. And there was a PowerPoint that Jim had sent, which I think only had one slide to illustrate the example of a garage that became a house. I don't know if that's available, but certainly for Scott, if that graph of CAFA funding could be put up on the screen, that would be very helpful.
Well, sometimes it's a little hard to do these things on the fly. We'll certainly check it out if sure. It's in OLIS. The staff can post it only if they're able to find it and do so. I don't want to slow the committee's progress.
Of course. Thank you.
We'll take a look at it.
Scott.
Okay. Hello, Chair Nathanson and Vice Chairs Reschke and Pham and committee members. I'm Scott Langton. I'm the Deschutes County Assessor, and I'm the co-chair of the Legislative Committee for the Assessors. I'm going to briefly talk about how county assessment and taxation system is funded. It's primarily from two spots, the County General Fund and then what the CAFA, or the County Assessment Function Funding Assistance Grant, which is overseen by the Department of Revenue. That fund is made up of recording fees and of a portion of delinquent property tax interest. Those funds are collected at the local level, and then they're sent to the Department of Revenue, who then reallocates those throughout the 36 counties based on what percentage it represents of what the county's budgeted. And then a very, very small amount of revenue comes from things like sales of maps or copies, and that only is the amount of that revenue just offsets the cost of producing that for the public. So there's no currently no other funding source for A&T administration. There's no user fees or administrative cost to the districts. It's really the County General Fund and that CAFA grant program. The graph that Eric referred to that you may or may not have before you shows that most recently the CAFA grant was revamped back in 2000, so 20 years ago. At that point, that CAFA grant represented about a third of A&T expenditures. So the 33% of the A&T function was funded through that. As that graph, if you have it, will show today.
And
it's less
we do. I'm okay. Confirming that it's posted and I'm looking at it right now. Thank you.
Fantastic. Yeah, so as you can see on that graph, it's about half of what was there before, and that's steadily declining. And what that means is the county general funds are having to pick up more and more of that. That was fairly stable as far as the monies that are in CAFA, around plus or minus $20 million annually. But over the 20 years, $20 million and the cost of what our services have have gone up in that period of time. So the gap widens between those, and the percentage of the grant offsets declines. And this creates the need for the county's general funds to pick up more and more portions of the assessment taxation function. And as you can well imagine, since Measure 50 passed in 97, that the landscape's really changed over that time, and it's not been equal for the different counties. You've got ONC counties such as Jim and Curry County, where their permanent rate factored in that they were getting federal monies for ONC that are no longer there. You've got counties like Deschutes County, where I'm at, where we've seen a tremendous amount of growth through that period of time. And then you see slower, low growth counties. So the impacts are different throughout the state as far as counties' abilities to fund. Does growth pay for itself? And as these general funds are having to pick up more and more percentage of the assessment taxation, then we go back to Jim's comment on, you know, we strive for that uniformity and equability between our taxpayers and statewide, and that puts that in jeopardy as we go through some of this. And the local county assessment and tax budgets all fall under the county commissioner's budget preview. So it's up to those individual counties to then fund those functions. And it will vary, but typically a county will receive less than 20% of the total taxes that the assessor or tax collector impose and collect, where they're funding over 80% of that function right at this point. And like I mentioned earlier, this gap continues to widen every year. And therefore, that's some of the reasons, and I appreciate being able to speak to your committee today And also the reason we brought forward two bills, House Bill 2385, which you're going to be hearing shortly, to hopefully allow us to help innovate and use those scarce resources much more effectively. And then Senate Bill 726, looking at a tax force for exploring stable A&T funding over time. So that's my quick overview in a nutshell, that, and be happy to answer any questions that people might have.
I know I'm going to have a few. And Mr. Colon, I want to assure you, I'm looking at the picture right now. It's the one with the title Carpenterville Road, right? Well, my goodness, that's not what I think fits the definition of a garage. If you looked in a dictionary or an urban dictionary or anything else, that's quite the place, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I believe they even have an ocean view.
Oh, my. Okay. I don't see any hands yet. I'm going to ask a couple of questions. First, this is a real quick one for Mr. Langton. You were talking about the O&C payments. There's a concept that applies more generally called payment in lieu of taxes, PILT. Does O&C fall under the umbrella of all those kinds of things that we would call PILT?
You know, I'm going to have to defer to Mr. Colon on that one, since he is an O&C county. Hopefully you know the answer to that one, Jim.
I'm not sure that I necessarily have the exact answer you might be looking for, but I believe the answer is no, that O&C payments are different from those payment in lieu of tax payments. And just exactly how different, I can't tell you today, but I can certainly, if you would like, look up that information and try and provide it to you at a later date. I apologize for not knowing more.
No, that's okay. The concept is maybe sort of the same, though, because
it is, yeah.
The federal ownership issues and so forth.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're there and you have the mic, if you will, I'm going to ask you a couple of other things. You mentioned your values and mission include a fair and equitable assessment system. And ideally, you would like to be on a six-year reappraisal process, for example. So this leads me to think about a couple of things. One is how we can help you and other counties get to this six-year reappraisal process. But even more broadly than that, one of the things that I'm thinking about sometimes is the degree to which our assessment and collection systems are the same or not the same from one county to another. Now, sometimes, of course, they're not exactly the same processes because the counties are autonomous in a regard, but you're all operating under one set of laws and one set of rules. So it must be quite different, though, from one county to another, how you're able to keep up, how you do assessments. Is it possible that one county, if you were comparing them in some sort of objective terms, is caught up at this percentage rate and some other county is caught up at a much higher or a much lower percentage rate? And then even apart from those objective measures, that's really about productivity or something, sometimes we hear that, well, from one county to another, the understanding of a particular law varies. But if we don't hear about it, we can't pass a bill, can't change the statute. We don't know that we need to change the statute to clarify it so that everybody understands it the same way. So do you have any thoughts for us on how we work toward a system where things are just more the same from one county to another in this process? I don't want to say all counties should be the same, because y'all are different and you're great for your differences. But I'm just talking about the processes, the administrative processes.
Well, I believe that there's a lot of cohesiveness between counties out there. We're all working towards the same goals. I think some of the differences that we see between counties, such as Curry, who has the lowest county property tax rate in the state of Oregon. So funding is really one of the biggest issues that we have for being behind, not being able to put enough boots on the ground, as it were. Whereas other, you know, I think the average tax rate for counties for the state of Oregon is somewhere in the neighborhood of $2.80 per thousand. Curry's tax rate is at 60 cents per thousand. And so in a county with a $2.80 per thousand tax rate, you know, it pays them to put more appraisers on, just like it does in the income tax system, where it pays you to have more auditors, I think, checking income tax returns. The other thing that I would say is, when you get into the larger counties such as Multnomah or Lane or Clackamas County, those counties are technology leaders. They're doing very well with testing out new technologies, such as working with aerial photographs and the programs that allow us to determine the differences this year as compared to last year in what has taken place on the ground from aerial photographs. And they're able to better focus their efforts towards going to those properties, as opposed to a more general approach like counties without a high degree of automation are able to do, where we essentially need to go door to door and find out the changes taking place on property. So there are reasons, but we do have the CAFA grant program, and there's a long list of responsibilities that we have to answer to for that CAFA grant program that is administered by the Oregon Department of Revenue. And so we are at least reporting, I think, on three or four different aspects of assessment and taxation to the Department of Revenue every year. So they're able to check out our functionality and ensure that we're doing the best that we can with the resources we have available. I don't know if that answers your questions. I hope it helps.
Yes, it's very helpful. Very helpful to have those observations. Thank you. Representative Marsh has a question or comment.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I want to describe a situation I ran into recently that I think is another consequence of the challenges we have in conducting reappraisal on a regular basis. I was contacted by a few constituents who live in manufactured home parks because of what they saw as a tremendous increase in their taxes. And I went back and looked at the records last weekend and saw in one case, for example, a manufactured home whose real market value in a single year went from $14,000 to $47,000. And the interaction of that RMV with the MAV, because of the way they set, meant that this manufactured homeowner, of modest means, saw their AV go from $14,800 to $33,000, more than twice as much increase, more than a doubling of their actual taxes, which for somebody who lives in a manufactured home was quite shocking. I'm still investigating why exactly that happened, but I'm assuming that some of this problem is that we just don't have a regular enough basis for reassessing and looking at properties, so that in this case, when the reassessment finally took place, the homeowner saw a tremendous, really overwhelming increase in their taxes. And I'm wondering if that's a situation that you see often, or if you have any comments on it.
That's an excellent point. And we actually do see that in Curry County. And part of the consequence of that is we went through the Great Recession, which in Curry County started to turn around, I think, in about 2013. And then after that, it took some time for the market to get going again, but the market certainly did start increasing back from the lows that we got to. But this last couple of years, I mean, we all recognize that there seems to be a housing shortage in the state of Oregon, if not nationwide. And manufactured structures are one of the most affordable forms of housing that people are finding out there. And I will tell you that we have properties in Curry County, manufactured homes, that we were carrying values of $6,000-$8,000. And we had people coming in because they're the most affordable form of housing there is. When they come on sale, they're commanding prices of $30,000-$40,000, just exactly like you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And one of the difficulties is not having the resources to get around and reappraise those as often as we might like, but also this exploding market that we're having now. And it's not just with real property or with manufactured structures. We're finding the same thing in real property homes as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One more comment. The irony here is that all of these manufactured homes that I was called to look at burned down September 8th. So now what we're trying to do is prorate bills that were exceptionally high that the homeowner didn't understand in the first place. So it's quite a mess. Thank you.
Representative Levy.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. One comment I will say is that from the sounds of those manufactured homes, after a certain age point, even though the value, the assessed value goes up, they cannot get homeowners insurance on them because of the age of the actual structure. I know this because I used to sell homeowners insurance. And so that becomes a problem too. And I have found when I was selling homeowners insurance that if the assessed value was lagging behind the actual age of the structure, they would give them an assessed value. And then they'd come in and say, well, I need to get insurance on this because they've assessed my value at it. And then we'd look at the age of the actual mobile home, and it did not meet the requirements of the insurance company to be insured. So my caution would be to pay attention to that, because if they can't get insurance on it, then they shouldn't be assessed that high tax value. And if it's only the land that it's sitting on, then they may need to understand the difference between the structure value and the assessed land value. Thank you, Chair.
Are there any other questions from committee members?
Was that a question that you were looking for a response from me on?
No, I just wanted to state what I knew, because I'm sure you both already know that as well.
Oh, yes. Thank you. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, sometimes the homeowners don't understand that, though. And so they look at the assessed value and they automatically think it's their home, and they're stressing over the assessed value, and they don't look at that part of that is also the assessed value that the mobile home is sitting on.
Are there any other questions for this panel? I don't see any. I'm going to leave the informational meeting open for right now. If the presenters want to stay with us to observe, that's fine, but you can turn your mics and cameras off now as I open the public hearing on House Bill 2385. Mr. Alanak, LRO is going to present the bill for us, and then we have some public testimony.
Madam Chair, I believe I'm giving Jamie a second here to pop in. Okay, go ahead, Jamie.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you, Madam Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. This is Jamie McGovern for the Legislative Revenue Office. HB 2384 directs the Department of Revenue to develop and implement, maintain software system that would enable online filing and processing of tax returns related to property. It would require the construction and maintenance of property tax return database, and that the use of the software system should be mandatory, and authorizes the authorizes the department to use database to produce anonymized reports, and the information in that database would remain confidential for any individual property tax owner or any individual filer.
Thank you. And before I call on the witnesses, we have three signed up. LRO, were there any additional people to sign up after the three names that I have already?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Reschke, could you join us for a minute? If you say a few words, your name will pop up and
in my video.
Thank you. Representative Reschke, I will probably be leaving the meeting for a few minutes to go testify in another committee. In the event that I leave for a few minutes, you're with the gavel. I'm passing it over to you.
I have my trusted glasses case here. Without glasses in it, I will use, yes.
Thank you. Okay, I'll let you know if I'm leaving. Thank you all. Okay, now let's hear from our witnesses. First, I have Mr. Shiratori, then Worf, and then Little. Could you please join us in that order? You can turn on your camera and your mic as you speak.
Okay, Chair Nathanson, when you're ready.
Now, this is
okay,
fine.
Okay, yeah. Chair Nathanson, committee members, Sage Shiratori, Oregon Department of Revenue, Property Tax Division. Thank you for just allowing me to say a few brief words on this bill. I have really just two comments today. First on the bill, the department has no position on it. But we would like to seek a little bit more clarity in terms of how to understand the bill. From our close and cooperative relationship with the county assessors, I think I understand that the intent of the bill is that the department would have a pretty narrow responsibility for creating and maintaining an electronic portal through which county officials and taxpayers could upload their returns and then access them. That, of course, has a fiscal impact. If I were not familiar with the topic and I were to just read the bill, I think it would also be possible to interpret it to mean, possibly, that the department would be expected to take on other functions that you would find under ORS 308-290 that could include processing, calculating, distributing, things that would change the fiscal impact by an order of magnitude. So just seeking some sort of clarity on that. The second comment I'll say today is just that, again, from our close and cooperative relationship with the assessors, we're very familiar with this challenge that most counties face in finding enough assessment and taxation funding, and have run through several ideas about how to increase funding to the county assessment function funding assistance grants. And all of those ideas run up against a variety of challenges. So, we're available and interested in a continued dialogue with assessors on how to meet that challenge, and would welcome any help from the legislature or others on how to do so. So that's all I have today. I'd be happy to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Derek Wharf.
Okay, let's give this a shot. Can you hear me and see me?
Yes.
Pretty good. Okay. Well, thank you, Chair Nathanson and Vice Chairs Reschke, and I'm not sure if Fam is on, but I see a number of people are. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Derek Wharf. I'm the Yamhill County Assessor and Tax Collector. I also have the pleasure of serving as the current president of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. House Bill 2385 for me fundamentally is about efficiency, convenience, cost savings, creating a credible database for itemized business assets at the state and local levels. And we've had some success in doing that. I'd like to share with you in brief just our transition from a paper-based workflow and how we got up and running on electronic filing and some of the success we've had with that. So to start with just a brief history of what was a strictly paper-based workflow for business personal property filings, really itemized assets, statewide, the business personal property filing due date is March 15th annually. That's the same for all counties, all A&T county offices. They're using the same filing forms. I should say the businesses within counties are all filing on the same forms. And so it's very standard in terms of the annual calendar and the documentation that's been submitted by our business constituents. Typically, you'd get together and put a mailing list together. You'd get together with a business asset list, a list of businesses, put to a pretty comprehensive mailing packet, if you will. And then you add to that the Department of Revenue's standardized form, maybe a welcome letter, and you mail those out direct mail to all businesses in the county. That was how we were doing it. And I think that holds true for most counties that haven't gone to an e-filing system. So preparing those mailings for December would take as much time as, we could be starting in late September and still be dealing with late filings from the prior year, turning the tax roll and just turning ourselves right into, okay, now we got to prepare for the next one. It was really an annual process to handle the paper-based workflow. Direct mailings, like I said, they included at least the form from the Department of Revenue and an asset list that was the prior year's reported assets as a guide to try to make sure businesses had information to make any adjustments, additions, deletions, typically done by hand, scratch them out, write them in, and all that would come back to our office. From that, we would start our paper-based sort of workflow, and they would come in from January till March 15th, some a little later, but the bulk of them come in that time period. And it was just it was really impossible to just get them in our office indexed, organized, and ready to be processed because we had so much volume of paper to deal with. And getting that organized and ready was a challenge. So in 2018, Yamhill County's businesses were notified. We had an extensive public outreach campaign. We let everyone know that our office was shifting to an online filing platform and going paperless. We used local media, newspapers, direct mailing little sort of cards to let people know, hey, just as a heads up, you're not going to be getting what you'd normally get is this paper-based packet. Without having to direct mail all of those business personal property return packets, that created an immediate savings on printing, mailing, postage. And that really just snowballed into time and labor savings because not only were we not spending 3 months putting together packets to mail out, when they came in paper-based, it took another 3 months to get them situated to be processed. Now what we've done is we've just spent the time reaching out to businesses and saying, hey, we're taking filings online. This is how you can do it. We have a partner that is a vendor supplying the online portal, or even the simplest form, you can at least fill out a fillable PDF and send us an email with your filing. That was sort of how it started, was getting people moving towards using the online platform. Previously, before we got to that point, it would take about 1.5 employees a full year to process the hard copy filings. And now we have a single employee that does the entire process in terms of gathering the data, uploading the data entry components in about 4 months. And we get to take the rest of those resources and her time and, you know, focus it elsewhere. And I'll talk a little bit more about how we've repurposed her to be an educator and to help businesses understand not only the personal property filing requirements, but also the tools and things that we have available to make it more convenient for them.
Pardon me for a minute.
Sure.
Committee, there's something I'm trying to make sure that I've got everything understood about calling on the witness list for today and getting ready to go to my other meeting. We're going to stand at ease for just a moment while we work out the conclusion of this meeting. We'll get back to you, Derek, and just
okay.
We're at ease. Great. Thank you. I apologize for that. We were trying to clarify the rules about the witness list, and everything is in order now. Derek is going to continue his testimony, and after that, we will hear from Tammy Little. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. So I left off with a little explanation about the number of full-time equivalent employees we had dedicated to the process in our office, and that we've significantly reduced that by going to electronic filing and going paperless. Right now, 45% of our taxable businesses file online, and we see that number growing annually. And the business community has been very receptive of it. And once they find out that it's available, they tend to embrace it and are thankful that we have this option available. And there's just a couple of counties right now that do. So it's been a win there. The other piece that's really helping is the storage and indexing. You know, just from the logistics of having a filing room full of filing cabinets, full of personal property returns that go back so many years. Once we switched to digital in 2018, we no longer keep hard copies in filing cabinets in large rooms. Everything's digital and easy to access for our employees to help with customer service and whatever else might come up. But also those that have been filing electronically in terms of the business owners can go in and look at their returns, their past returns that they've filed electronically, asset lists, and that sort of thing. So the sharing of information, the accessibility of it, having gone to a paperless and an e-filing platform has been significant. In going back to business and how they've received this, we've taken the extra time from our personal property appraiser, Samantha Williams, who she really led this initiative, but she's taken that extra time to go out and do education to businesses countywide. Not only this is how we now accept personal property filings, but quite frankly, there's a lot of businesses that don't know how to file today, even paper-based, or what they should file, what the timelines are, what the penalties could be. So the outreach to business has been significant, and it's been very well received. Let's see. We did have a comment that I wanted to share. I think this is important to note that we have business owners that cross over different county boundaries. So one large statewide business may be filing individually at, you know, 5 or 10 or more counties. And we do have, you'll be hearing from Tammy Little here in a minute. She also has gone, or her county has gone on a similar platform. And to that end, we had a business that was in both counties and reached out just to share their thanks and gratitude for having the ability to have a central repository. We go to one spot, we fill out what we need. We see both of our returns for the counties. We see our asset lists by the counties. And having that central piece was very beneficial to them. So they were very thankful to see that it was gaining some momentum, at least on these adjoining counties, Yamhill and Clackamas. So sort of in closing, I would say that the effects statewide, the potential this has, not only in savings for A&T offices, for printing, mailing, postage, time, labor, it's a convenient, streamlined process for businesses, And it will also help in getting more consistency statewide in filing. If we've got one place to educate, one place to send business to do their filings, then we're going to get a normalized data set that helps statewide for, you know, comprehensive analysis. We can break that down to the local level and look at it more clearly and more credibly, I guess, is a way to put it, because we've been consistent. And I think that's another opportunity here with an e-filing platform that will create a statewide benefit. That is what I have, but I'm open for questions if anybody has any.
Committee members, does anyone have a question for Mr. Worf? If none, I actually have a question, if that's all right. Mm-hmm. So your testimony was primarily about the benefits of moving from a paper world to a digital world and all the good things that can happen with that. So now that Yamhill County has done that, I guess my question is, if the state were to move forward with House Bill 2385, would Yamhill County continue as is? Would they have to relearn an entirely new system? How do you see that going forward?
Sure, thank you. Vice Chair Reschke, I think that was you. Yeah, so here's what I would see is, we've got two things. The front end of the process is all built around standardized forms already. Department of Revenue issues a personal property return form for the entire state. So to that extent, the data that's collected would be consistent across all counties. And that shouldn't change. They should be collecting that data now, maybe through different avenues, whether it's written out by hand via Excel spreadsheet, maybe there's some other methods that are happening. If we can get consistent in collection of the data, then how we treat it once we have it in a normalized data set is where I think the real benefit statewide can be. I say that because the data entry, the nuances of keying in itemized assets for every business and the time it takes to do that is probably the largest portion of the whole process outside of putting together mailings and processing the paperwork. So step one, if we get everybody down one channel on one platform, collecting the data, and then there's three tax platforms that are prevalent in the state. And two of them are already underway with e-filing and putting together an online platform. So how we're going to consume the data once it's collected, that's already started. So if we're a year or two down the road for implementation, I think we've got the sort of the flywheel in motion already in terms of taking the data set, making it usable at the local level as a way to upload into our tax platform, apply our local market trends, depreciation scales, whatever we need to finalize the tax roll, and then it'll go forward. So in a nutshell, we could easily transition to a central, or, you know, a central portal, if you will, because we're all collecting the same data elements. The differentiation between counties would happen after we have all those data elements and we get a normalized data set back at the county level. We may have some variations on how we import it into our tax platform.
Understood. Thank you very much. Any other questions, committee members? All right. Thank you, Mr. Worf. I think next, Chris, is Tammy Little. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Tammy, please go forward.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Reschke and FAM committee members. Thank you for allowing me to talk with you today. My name is Tammy Little. I am the Clackamas County Assessor and Tax Collector. I've worked in the Assessor's Office for 37 years, and I'm also a past president of the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors from 2015. And I'm here today as a member of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. I'm also providing a brief overview of our transition and initial results of moving to electronic filing for our business personal property accounts in Clackamas County. We are new to e-filing beginning this year, and I can confirm to you that we made a successful transition in a very difficult year on a short timeline, only because Yamhill County had already completed the online setup. We also have the same software application as Yamhill County, which was a key factor. Comparing our paper process to e-filing with regard to resource costs can be viewed in several areas. It's often not a focus of the costs, but prior to even receiving a paper filing, as Derek talked some about, there is an entire process with expenses for printing and mailing using our staff resources. To provide perspective on that, paper mailing for Clackamas County last year took the equivalent of approximately 4 weeks for one full-time employee to create files, print, fold stuff, mail, all the things that are involved. Going forward with the e-file setup, we can extract all of our inventory data, upload to an FTP site, and the data is ready for online filers within 1 to 2 days. In addition, there are also expenses to manage the high volume of paper filings returned to us before we even begin the labor-intensive process to manually work each return. In 2020, we used a minimum of just over 3,000 hours of support staff resources to process our returns that were filed. And that is in addition to two dedicated full-time employees that work on this. For an example of a cost comparison to process returns, a typical batch of 30 accounts, which would exclude any filings that are complex in nature, that takes us an average of 28 hours to code, enter data, and proof. With e-filing, we can review and upload that same batch of 30 accounts, and they can be completed in less than 1 hour. In addition, we've also received some positive feedback from many business filers, and our current count, again, this is our first year, our current count of returns filed were very similar to this time last year on the number filed. And it's really good news for us to note that 91% of those filed thus far were done so electronically. In summary, our conversion to personal property e-filing has been a notable success. We're still in the early stages of the process, so I don't have a full cost analysis, but the evidence is clear that we are saving tax dollars, we are reducing our processing times, we are increasing accuracy by reducing the need for multiple iterations of the data, and a great benefit resulting from using e-filing technology, Derek referenced it as well, is the opportunity that we can now reallocate staff resources, which in our case are greatly needed in other areas. So thank you for listening to me today, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ms. Little. Committee members, does anyone have a question? Well, I have one. Ms. Little, can you tell us how many counties have embarked on starting up e-filing out of the 36 counties? It sounds like Yamhill and yourself started this year, but do you have a sense, is it half of the counties that are now marching down this path, or is it everybody kind of waiting and seeing and wanting to?
I know many would like to. I'm not aware of any others besides Clackamas and Yamhill, although I do know that Multnomah and Washington County are working toward that with their software vendor. Derek might be able to speak more to that, but I think it's very few and many would like this ability.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Committee members, that's the end of the witness list. So any comments on this bill in particular? I see Representative Marsh.
Thank you. I just wanted to suggest to the committee one way that we might move forward. It seems like there's a lot that could be gained through this legislation and probably some rough edges to address. And I would like to suggest that perhaps the chair and co-chairs would like to consider putting together some kind of work group to work over the next couple of months and see if we can address some of the questions or challenges that have come up today. I'd be happy to help convene such a group if that were a decision.
I think that's a great idea, because if we can catch this early, I think, then we can do a good job. If people are already three quarters away of implementing systems and so forth, and it becomes much more difficult. So thank you. Thank you, Representative Marsh. Anyone else with a comment? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing now for House Bill 2385. Mr. Alanak, have we finished our business for the day, or do we need to make a comment about written testimony?
The one comment, Mr. Chair, would be the deadline for written testimony, which is 24 hours after the start of this meeting. So that would make the deadline for written testimony 3:15 p.m. tomorrow afternoon.
Facebook, this is Carson. So if you were unable to testify today in front of the committee, you have until 3:15 tomorrow to submit written testimony to get it on the record. And also, a benefit of our bicameral system is if this bill does move forward out of the House, it will be seen in the Senate, and there'll be an opportunity for another public hearing. Committee members, any final comments?
This is Jamie McGovern. Yeah. I believe our informational hearing is still open. I'm not certain of that.
All right. Well, I will close the informational hearing as well. Thank you, Ms. McGovern. Appreciate that. Anything else, Mr. Alanak?
That was it. You've finished the agenda, Mr. Chair.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I will adjourn the meeting, and we will see you tomorrow. Meeting adjourned.